notice blast.
Well, good morning and welcome, everyone. Today is Thursday, December 14th, 2017. It is 9 a.m. This is the Josephine County Board of Commissioners convening for our workshop, our administrative workshop. We've got Commissioner Morgan on the phone. Commissioner Young and myself are here. Good morning, Lily. Feeling better. Glad to have you on, even if it's just the phone. So item number one is position requisition for Chief Administrative Supervisor.
And hi, I'm going to move closer to the phone. Now that I realize it's there. And where we left off last week was that Commissioner Hare and HR Director Schofield and I were going to get together and chart a best path. And I think we've done that. And so where things currently stand, and what where things currently stand is that there's support, as expressed during the end of the board's last public meeting, for changing the position as described, changing the job description, in its entirety, actually, which would include, of course, a reclassification or a classification of the new job position as an NU16. The individual who is working in that position and who would be working in that position currently is an NU14. And so I have provided these salary tables with certain sections highlighted, and your HR director is here, so he's at the chair's discretion. He's welcome to join.
Oh, hey.
So anyway, we provided the non-union salary table with three different numbers highlighted. So what you see at the top at the end of the NU14 scale is step L20, which is where the employee currently is. So if the employee were to be bumped up to NU16, we'd be looking at basically a minimal $15 a month raise. And anyway, the board didn't seem interested in that, rightly so. And so where the kind of conference team left off was whether to assign that employee to the L15 row. And if Commissioner Bianchi, are you following what I'm talking about?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you. And so whether to assign the employee to step L15 or step L20. And that point remains unresolved as we sit here today. So that's going to be left to the board's discretion. So just to finish that point, I do advocate for the employee going to step L20 for a variety of reasons. We started to delve into them last month, but I know HR has an analysis of that, and so I would kind of look to Mr. Chair for which direction you want me to go next.
No, that's fine.
Okay. You
gave a pretty good overview. I think that the L20 is certainly merited. This is basically a new position. It hasn't been in legal before, and we're not going to go out and advertise as we've got a qualified person in-house. This is both a promotion and a creation of a new job based on some things that have changed in the legal's office. And I think it's a step in the right direction. For me, it's just there's an element of we're going to address another issue on that isn't on the agenda here, to the library disposition, something we requested several months ago following the election of the creation of the library district to divest those assets that are rightfully the district's by the end of the calendar year. And it's just really important that we have a prioritization. So part of this is going to come with a 6-month trial period where we're somehow engaged in the prioritization of what is coming and going through legal, setting time frames on those major projects, and making sure that they're kept. That's just key that we're making sure that we're staying within our commitments to that district. I think the entire board, including legal counsel, said we were very interested in meeting that deadline. It makes sense for a whole host of different reasons.
Well, I think it's important that legal counsel knows what the expectation of the commissioner is when they have a request. Pretty easy to say, okay, take care of this, and that's okay, but not put a priority rating on it. Say, I really need this by, and come to an agreement about how soon that can be done using you know, your department's expertise is not, you know, that's something you got to understand. This is a 6-month process, or this is a 9-month process, or something of that sort. I think it's very important that the communication be there rather than frustration mount up to saying, gee, I want that done by the end of the year, and it's just not happening. Well, maybe there's a reason why it can't happen or whatever. I think that conversation needs to happen earlier rather than later. Okay. And then I think everybody would know what the expectation is of the person proposing it. That make sense?
Yes.
I have to answer.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go ahead, Lily. Mr. Morgan?
I think that us allowing this position change would maybe enable that position to take that more of authority in setting those prioritizations. With it being a non-union supervisory role, there's a responsibility that goes with it of that time and stuff like that. So where right now you're kind of waiting for, as you're working with other people maybe to determine those deadlines, this is maybe further justification why the change of role is appropriate, so that the authority is there to say, no, these are the deadlines we have to meet. We want to make sure that we're on task for them.
I can empathize with the legal. Go ahead, Lily. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay. Then kind of switching, the other conversation that was brought up was about the L-20. And in all other situations, this is a longevity situation. That's what the L stands for, is longevity. And you have an employee that's worked 23 years, the L-20. And we had in the conversation last week that said if this is a promotion of sorts, that it would make sense to get the L-20. And I support that.
Okay. Great. I can empathize with where legal counsel is getting pulled in 100 different directions by every program, and every person within those programs has their priority, even the board. I've heard we get white papers or responses from legal on, well, a commissioner asked about this. I'm just going to use the example of a commissioner last year asked about what is the impact of the state raising the minimum wage on the county, and maybe whether or not we had authority to deviate from that or whatever. That is a waste of time for legal counsel to be evaluating issues like that. And legal counsel probably doesn't feel like it's their role to push back on the board to say, no, I'm not doing that. I have 10 other things that are the priority that the board has said I need to evaluate. And so I don't know how we help legal counsel in those regards, but I'm really going to look to you to help us help you, so to speak, and say, I'd like you to run your requests for legal counsel through the board so that if you have something like a memo, and I don't think that took very long, but it's cumulative effect. If everybody asks something that isn't a priority, even in programs, then the priorities are not done in a timely fashion, and we get stuff delayed. I'm coming about this because I've been dealing with the challenge in legal counsel. Arthur's the only one who's been in the room longer than I have in the Fords, but they don't get to ask that much. It's cumulative effect of a challenge, you know, and we're putting more resources into legal, but our expectations are going to be that the time frame in which things are dealt with is prioritized. And I don't want to belabor the subject, but I can't keep, you know, doing stuff that I think is creating a solution to the problem, yet we still sometimes see an old practice continuing. So I'm going to say that I would recommend we take another look at this in 3 months and evaluate the efficacy of this structural change, this promotion, and really delve into how did we do in that in the 3 months. And this can't just be the only thing that we're changing with this situation, with this promotion. There has to be stuff that occurs in a timely fashion. This library issue, next week is the last weekly business session that I believe that the board is going to have this calendar year. And I think it's incumbent that those things be brought out in a schematic of this is how we're dealing with the codification, this is how we're dealing with the library disposition. And really, all roads lead to this one person is really knowing how all that stuff, you know, I kind of think I do. You probably kind of think you do, but we've never done this before. And so it's just one of those deals that maybe the hesitation is in the fact that we're in uncharted territory. But I'm not going to be supportive of the L-20 in the sense that I think that there's still, this is a new position, and we're speculating on whether or not it's going to be effective in the legal office. So I think I'm going to recommend we go to the first longevity. That's just where I'm going to come down on this, that there's room to grow in that position. So it's an L10 is what I'd recommend, and that there's progressive increases as time goes on in the longevity of this new role. So I don't know if that is something, if the board is not receptive and wants to do.
What I would say is our standard practice with promotions in our policies that people get a two-step increase. Two-step is, within the non-union scale, is, I believe, 7.2% or 7.4%. If you move them to L10, that's less than our standard practice.
How far
if you move
less?
Them, it is 6% increase, I believe, about that. If you move them to L15, that's an 8% increase, which is slightly more than our standard practice by 0.5% or so. And then there's still another step that they can have to grow.
So if we did a reevaluation, if the board was inclined to go on my recommendation that we reevaluate this in 3 months, and we do it at an L10 with the expectation that potentially we could be moving it expeditiously to an L15 in 3 months. So we split the baby.
That's completely up to the board's purvey.
Okay. That would be my recommendation. Thank you for the clarification on what we typically do.
Yeah.
But that's where I'm going to... Lily, what did you... Commissioner Morgan, did you catch all that?
I did. A three-month evaluation is kind of different than the other evaluation periods we have. Generally, there's 6 months. But the only other concern I have about the longevity is... And the steps, when we have... steps previous to that, they're evaluated on an annual basis, and you know, if merit is observed, then they can get a step increase, but once they get to the longevity steps, 10, 15, and 20, they're evaluated on those five-year basis as a standard. So where we would pick one, it would be, yes, maybe because it's different, we can evaluate in 3 months because we say we're doing that. But generally speaking, it would be another 5 years before anything else would be looked at after that.
I think we do annually value.
I know that going,
not to interrupt you, Commissioner Morgan, but we do annual evaluations of staff. So
correct. But
so
once an employee gets to the L's
steps, they don't get a.
Those increases are at a five-year basis. They're based on years of service.
So
that's what the 10, 15, and 20 stand for.
In order to qualify, you have to have been here that long. But a good example is if I have a person who was promoted into a position and the promotion put them at, let's say, step 9, but they've been here 20 years, they'd qualify for L10 in 1 year, L15 the next year, and L20 the third year. And that's what our policy states.
Okay, so that's different than I understood that. And that would be my biggest concern.
Yeah.
That if this is going less than what our standard practice is, I don't want it to be a negative. And like I said, I understand that, okay, it's a new position, you don't go up to 20. But to go to the 10, I don't want it to be at the detriment of the employee. We are asking more of the employee. So, you know...
Yeah, I hear you exactly. I hear you exactly, Commissioner Morgan, and I don't disagree. I'm just looking for something of a benchmark, not necessarily an incentive, but something to say, you know, yeah, this is exactly working out the way we had intended, we expected, and, you know, the promotion to the longevity is reflective of exactly what we were looking for.
What happens if you went to L20 and then in 3 months you decide the program's not working or it's not working out like you said? Are you going to go back, or do you start at 10?
You change whatever it takes to get legal, your office working in the way that facilitates items that work through in a timely fashion, that they're not unduly held up. I think when the board sets a priority of something, maybe we don't always understand what everything else is going to take as a side seat, but I'm sure there are things that could take a side seat to say, nope, this is what we're doing. We're going to get it off the plate, rid of it forever, and move on. And that's... just got to make sure those things happen in a fashion.
Well, I like the three-month look at it again. I don't know if 3 months is long enough to really get a program of this magnitude up and going, but...
The next 3 months are not ideal. We're going to have 3 new employees and thing. And so she's in full training mode.
Yeah.
Things in terms of external requirements are going to come to a grinding halt, to be really blunt.
What?
I mean, I'm there, Leah.
Yeah, that's what I want to hear.
Leah's going to go into training mode, too.
So
and I've
6 months? I think that's good point.
What I would recommend is we follow our standard practice. Don't give the employee less than what we would normally give for a promotion. I don't think that's fair for the employee.
Okay.
We do, whenever we put someone in a new position, they have an introductory period. So we can use a six-month introductory period as we standard do. And frankly, that lines up quite nicely because it falls with the end of our fiscal year. And if the board is happy with the production that legal has instituted with the new thing, we move forward. And
okay. I think 6 months, I'd feel more, because we're going to have a month. First month is this one, and we're not going to get anything done for now until the end of the year.
Commissioner
Moore? Oh, I disagree.
Yeah, you will.
Yeah. We're going to talk about libraries next.
I think 6 months is appropriate as well.
And you're okay with the L15?
Yes.
Okay, sounds good. That's
Got
what
it.
We'll do.
Does that make sense?
That is a plan, and that makes sense.
Okay. Great. Thank you, JJ. Next item is 1B, Oregon Military Department Office of Emergency Management Performance Grant Agreement, CFDA, number 97.042, grant number 17-517. It's been in our packet. Standard practice, we match the money that is provided through the state for this service, and we've got that application in. We're in the queue to receive it. It's an $83,000, if my mind memory serves me well, something around that amount. Any concerns, Commissioner Morgan?
No, this is an important program. We need to continue to support.
Commissioner DeYoung?
Fine with it.
Sounds like
$83,386.
Great, thank you very much. I see this as a continuation of an existing practice, so it's a consent calendar item for me.
16 years
now
that we've been doing this. So,
Library asset dissolution, disposition.
Yeah.
I can't even read my own writing.
Yes.
It's not on the agenda, but I think it's both the dissolving of our historic administrative practice of overseeing. There's some funds, I believe. Arthur, do you want to come up? Some funds. There's property. So there's the Williams Building, the Illinois Valley Building and Property. We own nothing at the Wolf Creek other than potentially some of the collection. And then there's the entire collection and related assets. So we just need to move these orders forward. Looks like we've got four.
Yes, all of which are scheduled. I would suggest moving to next Wednesday's business session.
This is something we've been working on for quite some time after the formation of the library district, and this is a great codification of what it is we need to do. Really appreciate you guys putting it together. I think we've gotten everything we needed from the foundation as far as what they recommend to do with the assets, which we were waiting on, and they gave that to us a little bit ago. And so... ideally, if we could move this forward to the weekly business session next week, Commissioner Morgan?
I'm in favor of that.
You're okay with that?
We'll provide the
Okay, great.
Okay, we'll provide the exact agenda titles to
That's
staff
fine.
Following the meeting. A couple of items, the highlighted ones, because of, these entities are not probably going to meet before this Wednesday.
They met yesterday.
Well, then that's, so we're going to have to do that in January. The highlighted ones.
There's the ability to transfer the lease, and we can designate who we transfer it to, so we might want to do that. Terminate lease agreement with Josephine County Libraries, JCLI, who we exclude.
We could potentially have the board take action on these prior to the other
government
entity.
Yeah, I think we can. And then we won't be continuing the lease. Terminating it is fine. I think the lease requires 30 days notice of termination, so we'll have to do that. But or we could transfer the lease, which we probably have the authority to do within 30 days, to the new district.
We'll look into that.
Work. All of it takes. Okay.
Exactly.
IGA, school district, transfer by the district. Okay. Well, I think as long as we're making substantial progress in the direction that we had intended.
Yeah, I think we do the ones we can on this in this year. That shows, you know, if there are things that require their boards to meet or whatever, and they're going to next year, I'm fine with that. It's going to be by...
The challenge is they met last night. And
yeah.
They would have
and
done
they're not going
to
meet again.
What we did, what we would have needed them to do had we had it ready to go.
And I'm okay with that. Because
not looking to... Yeah. Point blame, but I have to illustrate the fact that they were ready to go, and but they've got a whole host of stuff they're working on. This is just one element, but it is kind of a fairly significant element, having jurisdiction over their assets and not wanting to. There's a property tax exemption, or there's ramifications for the district that they have to account for. That would be.
Can they schedule a special meeting to do it by the end of the year?
They were talking about doing that. If we move next week, they may just do that.
Okay. All right. I'm in favor of moving next week.
Okay. Great. We will do that and work on the details
between
now and then. Okay. That's all I had. Anything else?
Nope, I'm fine. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Wally.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Item number two is parks business. So, recreation land use between Bureau of Land Management and Josephine County for Lake Selmac. Historically, we've been operating without a lease agreement, if I'm correct.
It expired in 2007, unfortunately, but the original agreement was since 1961 when we had built Lake Selmac and developed the campgrounds, yes.
Okay. Well, take us through it, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so basically when out of the determination of two men, we man-built Lake Selmac, and with that, we put some campgrounds around it, had a longevity plan for building. The first set of campgrounds that went in was over at the Osprey Loop area, and the majority of that, I'd say about 75% of the land where we have current campgrounds is actually BLM land. So early on, before we started any of that, we entered into the agreement with BLM to lease a good chunk of their land, and the first lease was 25 years, the second one was 20 years. When the 2007 one expired, I'm not sure if it's just difficult to work with BLM or what happened, but we're about a year and a half into being at this point where we can re-sign a new lease.
It's practically impossible.
Yeah, and really, if we ever decide not to continue this lease, we are expected to return the condition to the way it was, meaning all mountain and no existence of man being there. And we might as well own it, but they're not willing to do a land ownership agreement. So we just continue with leases.
Do we have anything that they would want that we could trade for it?
Oh, sure.
Oh, we've been talking
at
about
some point in time?
A lot of this.
We're working on a legislative solution, but I really need a property manager to interface with Jameson and Sullivan, other lobbyists that we
have. Yeah, I think I would just
get this done.
Hate to see them at some point in time, depending on who's in BLM, at what point in time they go, no, we don't want you anymore, and now we want you to put it back to near 1895 standards. Say, okay, we'll pull the cork on the lake, and we'll just move on.
Yeah, there's also a small sliver on the other side of the lake with Mallard where our full hookup sites are, but a much smaller parcel.
And this new lease, is it for 20 years, 25 years?
20 years.
20 years.
At $0.
Does it have a renewal clause in it? The end of 20?
I'm wanting to say that there's not necessarily an automatic renewal clause or anything, but it specifically says that if we don't continue it, we have to, refer
it back. It addresses it, us not wanting to continue. It doesn't say if we want to continue.
I would have to look at all the verbiage again. I apologize. Yeah.
Thank you for your work on this.
It's necessary.
Yeah. I don't want to give it some thought before we move it forward, because it may be advantageous for us to try to work on a land swap without a lease agreement. The emphasis in trying
if a land swap is an option within, say, a year or 18 months, which it probably wouldn't be, then I would say we really do need to move before they get an idea that the land would be available and they get other ideas for it.
My issue is technically right now, if I need to get a permit in order to replace those toilets or even the office build we're doing, I cannot walk into the building department and get a permit. I have nothing that says I'm allowed to do the work. And so it's really held me up. I can't apply for any grants.
How does the lease go? How does the lease say if there isn't a new lease?
I would have to look through the language.
Let's just look at it offline. And, if there's a month-to-month element of it or whatever, let's look at that.
Okay. I mean, I feel 100% comfortable signing into the 25-year lease. It's exactly what we have been doing.
I don't mind that either, but
I
hate kicking the can down the road to some other board in 25 years that's going to have to deal with this in a more arduous situation. We're given an administration and a secretary that's probably... he's probably the best option we have right now, and there is going to be some sort of forest management bill coming out of conference in the first part of next year, and DeFazio's office and Walden office is looking for the recreational element is the nexus that gives you that authority to transfer lands to a local jurisdiction. And so with not having with having an expired lease and that sort of thing, I just don't want to sign a lease and then have it done in the spring, because but if you didn't have a lease, we would do it. But now that you have a 20-year lease, the pressure's off. Something to that effect. I just want to check that out real quick.
Sure.
That could be done before the end of the year. I'll just make a call to Walden's office and KP and DeFazio's office, and we'll see how that goes.
Okay.
So we need to start with one of these transfers. And, you know, I know that we have 11 of them or something like that that we want to do, but let's just start with this one that's so blatantly obvious and get the process down. Get everybody familiar with it, especially you, and then.
And this is one. This is one that would work positively.
Yes,
seems so. I'd give you a good track record going forward. Maybe some of the other ones that are more difficult.
The other ones might be a little bit more controversial. This one's not going to be. I can't imagine. You know, it's going to be impossible for us to.
I really don't like working without a lease, especially when it's been, what did you say, 2007?
2007, and so I haven't been able to apply for any grants or do any legal work out on the parcel.
There's no money. It says it's everything's a pass-through, but there's no... Have we been paying them money since 2007?
Originally, I think it was like 25 cents an acre or something like that.
Okay,
no, we have not paid them since 2007, and even the new lease is a $0 lease agreement. It's just a... Okay. A written statement that we have permission.
Well, I appreciate the BLM doing this. This is Elizabeth Burkhart and Alan Bolschweiler.
Yes.
You know, so I appreciate them doing this. One of the things that we've heard from the BLM is they can't lease out to the county and then have us generate a revenue stream off of that lease agreement. This is a completely... That's a false statement. If what we're doing is going to lease out some of these areas, it's our historic practice. So I'm looking at Hog Creek Boat Ramp parking area as the other one where it needs to be under one agency's jurisdiction, because it's a nightmare to have two agencies running one boat ramp. It's just not okay. So
a lot of parcels where we kind of leapfrog and we're picking up the burden of the cost of maintenance, and we can't charge users when they park on BLM land, so quite a few of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
At least two that I'm aware of, maybe more than that. So, okay, we'll do that. I'll call today.
Okay, great. And this one specifically would also need to have, well, we'd either be taking on more than 300 acres, or they would have to do a lot line adjustment for the tax parcel, because we're only leasing a portion of their parcel out there.
Okay.
Just to throw that out there.
If you wouldn't mind looking at... You've got lists, lots of them. Just put together a property list in the element. One of the things I want the new property person to focus on is tax lots and getting those up to date with properties that we're going to retain. When they did the Allen Creek realignment, they didn't switch any of the lot lines out there when they moved the road. Same issue that we have at the Demick Campus property. And yours has the same situation.
Yeah.
We need to... work with them on lot line adjustments. They don't have to be that hard, and especially if we have somebody working in-house with planning to do them. But I need a list for the new guy coming in or gal coming in next year. We're advertising for it right now. So.
Okay, perfect.
Good. Great. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much. I don't believe so.
Great.
Merry Christmas.
We all
got your notice about a discounted rate in park passes. I think we did that last year, right?
We did, and it was cleared last year because it is an existing discount of 50% off. We have that discount currently right now for anybody with a disability placard that comes into our office can buy one for 50% off, and so it was approved.
Great.
But, yes.
It might be advantageous to just give a heads up to the board if you think about it next year before you send that out. It didn't. I just
apologize.
Checked in and said, are we doing this? And I there's a lot going on, and I forget stuff. So
yeah, I kind
if
of
you think about it.
Yeah, I assumed last year when we talked about it that it was just going to be kind of continual
through
the years. It
makes sense, and that's exactly the response that I got from those I checked in with, and so it
was
great. It just is a matter of a heads up.
Understood.
Would be great. So
I will.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Airports is item number 2B. It's good to see. I'm sorry, Commissioner Morgan, are you okay with everything on that? Still with us?
Yes,
okay.
I
put
all of
this
disagree.
Okay, great.
I hope, Sarah, I'm going to be getting one of those passes again.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Bring your placard.
I have no doubt that you reach out. So, okay, item number 2B is IGA number AJW. 00-1837 between the FAA, the Josephine County Airports, for flight check of new runway lighting at the Illinois Valley Airport, an exciting item. And then item number 2 is task order number 11, amendment number 4, consultant services agreement between Josephine County Airports and WH Pacific Engineering for additional services during construction of the West Side hangar access and taxi construction. So, Mr. Graves.
Good morning.
You look like you're feeling a little bit better.
Yeah, I am.
Good.
Kick this cold eventually.
Great.
Yes, this IGA intergovernment agreement with the FAA is a routine agreement with the air traffic office. It's different office than we typically contract with for our grant agreements, which is the airport's district office, or the ADO. But it's related to the grant aid construction work out at the Illinois Valley Airport, in that once we install the upgraded electric system, the runway edge lights, the precision approach path indicator lights, which we call PAPIs, and the runway end identifier lights, which are very bright strobes on each end of the runway, and we call those reels. The air traffic office is required to do a flight check to make sure that they're performing exactly the way they're supposed to be. And
they're trying to achieve uniformity?
Correct.
So throughout the whole system?
Throughout the entire...
Okay.
Air traffic system, correct.
Okay.
So, and there are very clear specifications as to how all of these lighting systems need to perform, and how many degrees, minutes, and seconds up and to the left and to the right they shine out and everything. So they have the most practical method of measuring all of this is with a flight check with an aircraft that's specially equipped with all this GPS equipment. They can identify exactly where they are in space and in 3Ds, and they can determine if the lighting systems are.
So if a pilot is coming in, he knows when he sees such and such a light that he is in within
safe
proximity to the end of the runway and so on and so forth.
Exactly. Yeah, and this is all primarily done in the name of safety. And it's legitimate. I mean, so the airport's district office, who are the money bags, the people who provide our grant money to us, they recognize that this is a function that needs to take place and it's expensive. So they finance this as well, along with the rest of the construction grant. So we will be receiving 90% of the cost of this flight check, just as we are 90% for everything else associated with this grant. And that's a good thing, because this flight check is about $32,000, okay? So that would ordinarily be money directly out of our operating budget, and the airports department is pretty squeaky in terms of extra money. So this is a routine type of arrangement. We've done one recently at Grants Pass. We'll probably be doing another one at the Grants Pass Airport fairly soon. And the protocol is...
Do you have to go back and start all over again when you make any changes? Or is it just
changes
to the runway?
You have to get a flight check if you make changes.
Okay.
But they won't be checking the entire suite of airport lighting if you've just changed, for instance, the location of the runway end identifier lights. So, as an example, we paid for a flight check when we installed brand new runway end identifier lights at Grants Pass Airport. And on grant 10, it was agreed that they would give us money to install those lights. And they were set to work in conjunction with an existing system, okay? That existing system failed because it was 40 years old. And it's now been replaced with money from Grant 11. And because of the new system that's been replaced, the newer system, that the reels that were put in just a year ago, have to be relocated. So now there has to be a flight check of those reels because they've been moved from 40 feet to 70 feet left, right of the center line, and it's, you know.
Do they only check when there's a change, or do they come in periodically and say, you know, you're at your five-year mark, we're going to come check your whole system?
They do periodic checks. Those are at no charge to the sponsors. And they, their office, depending on budget limitations, they will take off and fly around the country and do these random checks on systems.
Like OSHA, you know, and I get back to OSHA and SAFE and all that. If you call OSHA, everybody thinks they're scared to death of OSHA, but OSHA has a has an element that says, you want to come out and see, you want us to come out and tell you what's wrong with your place of business? We'll be glad to do that.
Yeah.
We'll leave the ticket book home.
Yeah.
And we'll just bring our pad, of correction pad, with us.
Right.
And you can do that at any time. And that's one thing that I was just wondering if they had a process to where if you say, you know what, I think I want to just get checked out one more time.
Well,
would they do that?
They have that process, and they will do that, but they'll charge you for that if you ask them to come and do it. If they do it as part of their regularly scheduled random check program, it's at no charge.
Regularly check program.
They have a regular program of random checks.
Of random checks.
Yeah. Okay. And they're the ones who schedule it. I have no idea.
Just him checking to make sure you're okay.
That's right. Semantics are so much fun.
I'm slow, but I've not stopped.
Okay. Right. So in any case, this IGA, it's complicated, but the airport's district office is going to give us the money, and then we give it to the flight check people. They do the flight check, and then the airport's district office refunds the money to us, 90% of it. So it's a three-way thing. But this is the vehicle that creates the contract between Josephine County and the air traffic office, who's conducting the tests. Okay. That's way more information than we need, I know, and I apologize for being wordy about it, but any questions about that? Okay, so our cost, I mean, the bottom line here is that the airports department will be responsible for about $3,200 as a result of this contract, and we will find that money.
Okay.
Second item.
Yes, sir. Task order number 11.
So task order 11 with WH Pacific is our engineering consulting firm at the Grants Pass Airport. We have them under contract to perform services during construction. And so since airport sponsors typically don't have the expertise required for airport civil engineering, we have these consultants, and the FAA requires us to have somebody on staff who is capable of doing this work. So WH is it. We have an existing contract with WH Pacific for services during construction on Grant 10, which is the west side hangar access area. The FAA has agreed to increase the amount of that grant to us because we've identified additional work that should be done at this time. And so the FAA has agreed to do that, and they will provide us with an additional $38,000 for that work. Of that, and so we'll have an IGA change, and we'll have to sign a contract change with the FAA to accept that additional $38,000. That money will go to pay the WH Pacific contractors for services during construction for the additional work, and also to Copeland Paving for the additional work. So Copeland Paving is doing the dirt work. WH Pacific is doing the engineering services during construction. So this particular amendment is to amend our contract with WH to provide an additional $16,000 for their work during this upgrade or increase on the grant.
And cost of the county is 10% of that.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, and I've already applied for a core grant for the additional 10% match and was turned down because we've received an original core grant for the original grant match money. And their policy right now is, even in the case of an increase in the amount of money that the FAA is going to give us, which increases our match requirement, they will not provide that. So
that makes sense, because you could keep going back again. There's a lot of paperwork on their side.
Well, yeah. They have a finite amount of money to contribute to something that round, and so.
But I just wanted to point out that I did attempt to. Get that.
I think it brings up. Yesterday we had your unofficial ambassador from RVX, from the airports, Mr. Larry Ford, prepare present the robust applications that you put in to through that process.
Uh-huh.
And I just wondered if, yeah, he was talking about the virtues of how successful you were, but for this one safety-related application at Medford's airport, you were right there second in line with a lot of stuff.
Right,
so.
Right. And the Medford application does have a higher priority,
yeah.
Not just because they're bigger or that it's safety, but it's to provide match money for an AIP grant that they either have or they're about to get. And that, across the core program, that's always the highest priority.
I wonder if it would be helpful, if something you probably already have, to kind of outline what you're doing this year. It's funny because I've been out to Copeland. I was there for, you know, stuff at the ranch looking for aggregate, and I saw their list of projects, and it was amazing how many, you know, you got your name is all over that board. But it would be kind of helpful for me, and probably I think we're looking at potentially switching a liaison in January to Commissioner DeYoung, for him to have like an outline sketch of
sure.
where you are and where you're going, what you're applying for, in a kind of a one-pager, because you got a lot of stuff going on.
I was
going to
say,
I'm
thinking the grease board back here
to
keep up with the airport.
We have a grease board in my office, and it is full from top to bottom and left to right with
you just swing out after first year, take a picture of that.
Yeah, well, I'll take it and send it to you. But yeah, I'd like to
That'd
have you
come
out.
That'd be helpful for me too.
Sure, you bet.
I used to be able to follow everything that was going on out there, but I don't have it in. I don't remember.
Well, it used to be sleepy little airports.
It did. Yeah. So I would really appreciate that. The other thing wanted to bring up was lasers. I don't know if it's an issue at both airports or just Grants Pass, but I know that you had sent an email to our sheriff's office and wondered what kind of a response. It seems pretty important that we get a handle on that. Lasers being a linear element, maybe we can track it down to find out. You seem to have pretty specific location about where it was coming from. So.
Yeah, and we have a couple of pilots who fly more at night than other pilots, and this is a nighttime issue.
Yeah.
It becomes much more of an issue, you can imagine. It's very dark, and if you illuminate the cockpit of an aircraft with a laser, it's blinding to the pilot, and that's not a good thing at night, especially at night, and especially when they're on final approach into Grants Pass Airport. So,
what kind of an offense is that?
Well, it's a federal offense, and I just read the statutes on that, and I believe it's like a Class 3 felony. I mean, it's considered a minor felony, but it's the enforcement can be pretty severe. There are people in jail right now, in prison, who have been convicted of illuminating aircraft with lasers.
I'm not so sure that our DA's office is dialed in on this, maybe even our sheriff's office. So I think at the direction of the board...
It wouldn't go through our DA's office. It'd go through the federal court in Medford.
Whoever needs to be in a room, I would recommend maybe this could be a task of yours before you... because you're familiar with this system, obviously, that maybe you pull those players together, Commissioner Morgan, in a timely fashion to say, this is a growing issue. It's probably something that they deal with in Medford or other regional airports.
They do.
Would that be something you'd be willing to do? If
I would be willing to find out who's the charging agent, because that was one of the questions I had, is how do we get somebody charged in the federal court? Generally speaking, it's working with the prosecutor, the attorney general's office in Medford, but I believe the sheriff's office may be the first, or the city police would be the first investigator, whichever that is, and then it gets referred to them. So
yeah,
I'll follow up to see if we can make sure that's done.
And I'd like to add that there's, as I mentioned, several pilots who fly predominantly at night and are affected by this and have been affected by this over the years. Most of the pilots who fly for Dutch Bros have had lasers shined on the aircraft on final approach. The PacJet charter company, that their chief pilot has been illuminated with lasers. And we have a private citizen who flies predominantly at night locally around here, Grants Pass between here and the coast or here in Medford. He's been illuminated quite a bit by lasers, maybe because he does fly so much at night. I'm not sure if that's the reason. But in any case, they're all aware that they need to, as as much as possible within safety limits, try to figure out where that's coming from.
Absolutely.
And then what the FAA does is they rely on local law enforcement to be their boots on the ground, so to speak, and try to help identify the source of the laser illuminations. The FAA doesn't have any bandwidth at all to be able to put investigators out into the field and have them sitting there waiting for, you know, a report to come in and then run over and try to find those guys. Not that local law enforcement does, but I just wanted to elevate the issue to the awareness of Sheriff Dave Daniel and also Grants Pass Chief of Police, and that's why I copied them on my recent correspondence with the FAA. Eric Ramsayer of the FAA Flight Standards District Office in Portland has been very responsive and provided a lot of guidance, and he basically needs the pilots to go online, file a report with the FAA so that it's documented.
Right.
And so I've encouraged all pilots in the Josephine County community to do that. I've provided that link to everybody in a master blaster email, you know. And,
are lasers a frequency?
Yes.
Just one frequency?
In fact, they're a pure frequency. And you either have a neon laser or you have a NID-YAG laser. And the neon lasers are red, NID-YAG lasers are green. And it's like neodymium yttrium, I think, is what then the acronym is NID-YAG. And,
so, Larry, you're saying the FAA is who refers the charges to the court system.
Yes.
If I could recommend you guys working on this, I just wanted to highlight it, and I'd like a plan of action to deal with it. I think it's just, you know, probably a couple of kids or somebody, and the once you take care of it, it's done.
Yep.
Or a mailing going out to everybody in that flight path area that says, "Are you aware that that's a federal, you know, that's prosecutorial, right. blah blah blah," something to that effect, coming from the sheriff's office. Those are just ideas, Lily. I'm sure you're going to come up with something great and effective that gets out to people that says, this is unacceptable, and I don't want to have to deal with this, you know, in an aggressive way after something happens catastrophic. Yeah. It needs to be done.
I've been working with Jeff Duell, the Daily, the local courier paper, and so there's an educational process here that you're talking about.
Yes.
And we may be able to do a direct mailing to people under the flight path, but I think that articles in the paper that highlight the issue, it's a two-edged sword. Sometimes it gives somebody an idea that they shouldn't or didn't have before, but primarily it's to act as a preemptive, you know, educational thing. And, hey, don't do this. It's not good.
Could you fashion a road sign that says you're entering the proximity of an airport, use of lasers beyond this point is not... is prohibited FAA, such and such, so that anybody driving down the street can read that?
We could do that. I can work with Rob, maybe, in Public Works here in the county.
You'd have to say what
you'd like to see is a recommendation based on best practices. This is not an issue just here.
Right.
If we don't want to say, we don't want to reinvent the wheel and have it be wrong, that an op-ed actually causes more people to think about that as an option as opposed to doing something effective like a direct mail, if that's the effective way to do it. You guys need to just work that out.
Okay.
I just wanted to highlight it and make sure that we're working on something.
So very good.
Anything else? Thank you, Mr. Graves.
I'm good. Thank you.
Hope you get better.
Commissioner Moore, you good?
Yeah.
Okay. Item number 2C is Human Resources request for approval to move forward in process for policy revision change. Mr. Schofield.
Hello, Commissioners. So, a couple weeks ago, I brought some policies to the board with some recommended changes. The process was for the board to give a provisional approval, then it goes to our collective bargaining units for 14 days, to spend the 14 days. So now it's back to the board for final approval.
So you did send it to bargaining units, and everybody then their response?
They didn't have any response, which is typically what they do. They
didn't respond at all, or
nope. Usually, they only respond if they think one of the policies is a mandatory subject to bargaining that they want to bargain. So if we have a policy that they disagree with that falls under the purvey of mandatory subject to bargaining, then they respond. And if it's anything other than that, they typically don't.
What kind of change? Did you not make any change? There's 67 pages, and I can't imagine that in 67 pages somebody doesn't have something to say.
But it has to fall under a classification that they're allowed to bargain it. So if it has to do with conditions of work,
that
pay,
narrows it down. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. All right.
And they have rules within their collective bargaining.
I only found one area that I had made that recommendation on changing. So they were reasonable and they seemed common sense changes.
Do you mind letting us know what that one recommended change was and did it happen? Or are we going to approve that as part of this process to have it move forward, Commissioner Martin? Do you remember? Or
My concern was that it stated that before an employee could leave, they had to have prior permission from their supervisor.
Written permission, right?
I was just worried about that we would set somebody up to fail if the supervisor was unavailable. It doesn't say notification to a supervisor prior to departure, because that doesn't require a response, but prior permission requires a response from the supervisor. And so I had just asked that it be amended to say supervisor or designee, or something along the wording that it's not getting an employee in trouble to no fault of their own because the supervisor was unavailable.
And really what the board asked was to give another option. And so I added an option, but I added it in another place that makes it broader than just that one specific policy. And that is in page 3 under employee participation. I added a little language that basically says the board is always an option if in the communication chain.
One of the concerns that I have along those lines was yesterday's union hearing regarding the termination of an employee. And we had employees that were invited by the union, did not ask permission, but instructed their supervisors that they were going to attend this hearing. And for me, that there's no provision in our contract. It was totally inappropriate to have that outside of the contract, and they didn't ask, and permission wasn't granted. It didn't even feel as though the manager felt that he had been asked or given permission. It just... And I don't want that to happen again. There needs to be clarification with the employees about who is going to be included in those things and when and where and how. Because we had, I don't know how many employees in one program or two programs sitting out waiting for an hour. And we're not necessary. So it just feels like a breakdown in how we're facilitating these. That and other, union-related activities that are, it's got to be really clear guidelines and people held accountable for what the rules say. So,
and I did meet with the union rep and talked about there is some ambiguity in the contract as it relates to the grievance process. There is a line in it that says that testimony can be taken from witnesses, but it's a bit ambiguous. So we agreed to
work on that
in the next round of collective bargaining.
Great. I want some pretty specific clarity, because I want the rules not made up on the fly. That's where people get into, the opinion that you're being less than forthright or fair in the situation.
Sure.
And for me, I don't like the idea that we're building on precedents, deviating from the rules. We need to get back to what the rules say. And if the rules need to be changed to facilitate the intent of what everybody wants to do, that's fine. But, and this may not, this isn't the place to do it, but the collective bargaining contracts, that's the place. And boards need to just understand, HR and managers need to instruct boards that this is what you want to do. Because as you start getting out, then what's the point of the contract? I mean, if it's past practices and that's the rules, you never get back to what you agreed upon, and it just atrophies.
I think most of the angst is because it wasn't clear in the first place, and all those people showed up, and had they been told, no, you know, this isn't a place for you to testify, they wouldn't have showed up, and they probably would be about, their mad meter would be probably at 25% of what it was yesterday, because they came here fully expecting to be heard, and then weren't allowed to be heard.
Right.
So they should know that going in. That should, I agree, clarity, but that's for you guys to do at bargaining.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, great. All right, we'll move this forward. How is that usually done? Do you guys want to do it?
I will draft a board order, and it will basically state that it'll list these policies and state that they'll be incorporated into the personnel policy manual.
Yeah, great.
So I did want to bring a couple things. So there's a couple things that changed between 2 weeks ago and this week. One was page three, where it talked about employee appreciation or participation. So that was one of the changes. And the other one, and I don't know if I've had a chance to speak with all three of the board members, but it was a change in the non-union rules Director Ryan came forth last time and had a question about our accumulation of vacation time, basically. And so I put a rule in that would be used as a tool to help or encourage people to manage their paid time off effectively. So it will allow people to cash in basically 1 week of their time if they meet certain criteria. The criteria is they have to have a minimum of 150 hours on the books, which is half of the payout cap when you leave. But they also have to take a minimum of 3 weeks throughout the course of a 12-month calendar. So they have to manage their time. They have to take the time we give them so that they're properly rested, but they have to save enough so that in case something happens, they have enough to cover. So if it's used as a tool to foster proper management of time, I found value in it.
That's been one of the greatest challenges, I think, with our managers. Not when we don't have middle management, they don't feel free to be able to leave the office mm-hmm. long enough to get rested and rejuvenated. And I think that's a resounding element in most of our programs. And whatever we can do to incentivize that, kind of meet it in the middle with a cash out provision, but an incentive to say you can't do that unless you've done this.
Yeah.
I think it gets where we want to be.
Well, it's tough for me to, when an employee comes in and says, I'm just burnt out. And then you look, they have all this time, vacation time on the books that they didn't take.
Yeah.
But as you say, if they can't take it because of understaffing, that's a different deal.
Well, a lot of it is, and it's challenging because we don't have deep command structure anymore. And so it is challenging, but it's one of the things we do is they need to come to and say, liaison are having a hard time. What can we do to foster a program within my department that can allow me to take time off? And then we'll work to figure out maybe we need to train one of your folks up to be a good lead that can take over while you're gone or whatever that issue is. It's different for each department.
They've earned that time off. It's
Absolutely.
Their time off. And I think, we need to facilitate them being able to take
it. Airports is probably the biggest example of where there wasn't depth in there in his program when he came on board. It was him or nobody.
Yeah.
And he's built a team now where I think he feels confident that he can go away for a couple of hours or a couple of days, and everything's going to be okay, and he's a cell phone call away, but at the same time, there's somebody there who's going to know enough, and that's only increasing over time as people become more experienced. I mean, some of your staff hasn't been there for multiple years. They haven't gone through a full cycle yet of whatever could happen in a year, and there's a lot of programs that are that shallow.
They need to recognize that and work towards a solution on that. If they just keep letting it go on and on and on with no solution in sight, it festers.
One of the elements that we've tried to work on is cross-training within managers, but it's so challenging for them to be freed up. They're not covering their own program, let alone being able to be free enough to go explore what is it like to run parks for a day. That's not practical, but at the same time, we need somebody. It kind of comes back to that, organizational element of that central component that really can step in at a moment's notice. Because otherwise, when Mr. Graves isn't there, it's the airport manager, public works director that's often been put in charge of other stuff. Well, that's not exactly conducive to public works or any other program. So having that central person that can be a fill-in, a gap to any program at any moment isn't easy to find, but I think it's going to be integral for us moving forward in ways. I mean, we've had five different planning directors, community development directors, and our ability to fill that gap going forward, Mr. Converse isn't there anymore, and I'm not sure that was really stellar. He was great, appreciate him serving, but there isn't anybody to come in to fill in for community development when that gap goes.
And hiring that one person may prevent you from each department hiring that next person.
as far as
you could have one person that could basically, I can build a campfire, but I can cook the beans and I can I can set up the tent.
Yeah.
You know, one person that can do it all.
I think
Or has has the expertise to do it all.
Yeah. So anyway, not to get sidetracked. But
that's all right.
A broader conversation.
It allows the opportunity to brainstorm. The last thing that needs just a little discussion is part of the policy change is restructuring the salary table structure for our directors. So I want to make sure that the board is all in congruence with that concept.
Yeah, you've taken a look at it. I think we've independently kind of taken a look at that, and it makes sense. I think we're tracking along the lines of what we need to do to stay competitive and be reflective of the job that people are doing. So how do we want to move that one forward? Mr. Morgan, where are you on that? You've reviewed it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think it... after looking at the charts the last time, it seemed that they do need to be adjusted.
Okay.
And so I support that.
So I will wrap that up as part of the policy change, because it really is a policy change that changes the structure of the salary.
Right.
And so it'll all be part of the packet. It'll go before I'll have a board order, and it'll list, and it'll say, attachment A, and it'll have everything changed.
Okay.
List it out.
Great. Sounds really good. We'll move that forward then. Anything else?
That's all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have two quarterly department updates listed. However, I understand facilities is needing an excused absence, and I granted that this morning due to personal reasons. And so I'm going to go into item number 3A, which is Mr. Guy Rand. Seems like you're here a lot, but it was the justice reinvestment.
Yes, sir.
That was a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
Huge deal.
And the budget as well for
community corrections.
I'm normally not that tall to hit things.
Yeah.
Turn that in on workman's comp the other way.
Right.
Yeah. Hitting the head with a pine cone.
Yeah.
We got a copy of this. But that's
not going anywhere.
You did, yes. I sent it to...
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me today. Today I'm before you with our quarterly report. Many numbers, lots going on at Community Corrections, as you're well aware. Our total population grew. We were cresting over 1,000 last quarter. Now we have increased to another 35 cases, which equates to roughly an entire caseload. So I just wanted to call your attention to that on field services side of our quarterly report for the total population.
On a graph over, say, a 10-year period, 10 years ago, did you have 742, and you're seeing a constant shift?
I can look back. That's before I got here.
Okay.
I can look back on what those numbers were for Josephine County.
I'd be interested, because we always bring it up. Measure 91 had an impact on Southern Oregon, a real big impact. Mm-hmm. And maybe that is a number that we may be able to use to show that we've had a increase in traffic in community corrections.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you in the last 3 years that I've been here, we have seen an increase in our population, and that's even after House Bill 3194 passed and the implementation of earned discharge, where we have been deploying our resources to identify the folks that earned discharge off of supervision. That was pre-2013 that wasn't in place. So since that has taken place, even us participating in earned discharge, getting people off of supervision, our numbers and our population has increased. And so,
they're going up.
Yeah, they're still going up. And
so does that indicate that the severity of their crimes, in other words, you're saying, I'm going to get this guy off because he's at this level,
yeah,
but he's being replaced by two guys up here.
There's a number of factors that are contributing to that population increase. Our resources in terms of prosecution have increased over the last few years. We've seen an increase in our short-term trans leave, folks that are eligible to be released from prison. So that's also contributing to those numbers. There's a number of other factors that it's difficult to explain and pinpoint just one of the reasons why, but there's a lot that's going on. But if you boil it down, the folks that we're receiving are all convicted in terms of felonies or misdemeanors, and that means that there's a lot of crime going on, and we have over 1,000 people on supervision that we're trying to get them to stop committing crime. So lots of different factors. There are social and so on and so forth. So significant division notes that I'll call your attention to. For the field services, we have hired 3 POs using the Justice Reinvestment Funds, as well as the grant and aid that we got an increase from the state on. 2 are attending the academy in January. We're hoping to get those folks trained up, and then they'll hit the ground running, because we have a lot of work to do for them. We've identified caseloads for them. One of them is going into our sex offender unit from the academy. The other one is going into field services for general high-risk felony supervision.
Mr. Conrad, yes, I need to interrupt.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to have to step out for just a minute. Are you comfortable continuing? Or?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pardon my...
We've started the treatment accountability team, and that is geared around and focused on folks that are failing to show up, that are high risk in treatment. So as soon as our team is notified that they didn't show up to treatment, we are deploying some resources out into the community to knock on doors to get them transported and back into treatment, so we can get them changed. We've initiated some restitution collections efforts. We've noticed that we've seen an alarming rate of restitution collection that is not in the area that I want to be in terms of collecting it. So, and restoring.
Is that people just shining it, saying, I'm not paying anymore?
Pretty much right now, there's a lot of different factors around restitution, but we are making some efforts to collect some restitution from folks that haven't been paying. It's estimated from our office that we have just under $1 million that's outstanding in restitution collection, and so we have to put some efforts towards that. We're taking some initiatives to get an understanding of how much exactly is outstanding, how much we have collected, and then make some modifications in our operations to target those areas. So currently, it's difficult for us to know exactly how much, because there's some technology difficulties that we're running into. We're shoring those up right now, and hopefully we can get an accurate account of what a restitution is.
The court system issues restitution. They're the ones that put the restitution on. Then they just hand it over to you to collect it?
It's in the sentence order. We're entering in the data. There's some changes with e-court. We used to be able to access exactly how much has been paid. Now we can't access that information, so we're working with the courts to gain access to that. Like I said, lots of different technicality difficulties or technical difficulties to get those systems to tell us what exactly their restitution is owed. So we're working on that. It's hard. And then there's laws in place too, where the folks that we have on supervision, if you owe restitution on cases that have been expired for years on end, right? Those restitution collection amounts go to the oldest cases first, and then there's also restitution that is it's intended to pay restitution, but it goes to court fees as well, and that's in statute. So those are some of the difficulties that we're running into. To get the folks that are on supervision and the victims paid out of the pot of money that's going.
Is there an element of that where you could say will discount it if you pay it by a certain thing. Like, for instance, collection agency says, you know, what? I know the guy owes you X number of dollars, but would, you know, what would you take to just end this right now? You're going to get $5 a month for the next 120 years, or what would your payoff be to stop this whole thing?
Yeah, for
restitution, your record.
For restitution, it's different because
we want because it's court ordered.
It's court ordered, and we want to restore the victims 100% on what was court ordered, okay. And so we want to stay out of that negotiation piece of it for victims, unless you know the victims had agreed to that.
I mean, who could? I'll just use myself. I have a restitution amount for in the $2,800 range, mm-hmm. and that was for a crime that was committed 25 months ago, 20 months ago, mm-hmm. and I know the young man is going to get out of the slammer, and I have not seen 1 ounce of restitution. I know it was ordered, but you know, the incentive is I'm never going to get it back. But I mean, if you could go to the guy and say, you know what, the victim says he'll take half, maybe that's an option. I don't know how to, if that's not your job, though, I guess.
Well, you are definitely not alone when it comes to not getting paid back by
I knew that going in.
Yeah, and so we're making some steps to hopefully rectify that situation. So. Okay.
And generally speaking, they don't pay restitution while they're incarcerated.
Okay.
Once they get out and get on supervision is when that process would begin.
So if I started getting a check from the guy, I can assume that he's out? Or
unless
not?
Unless somebody's paying on his court fees while he's incarcerated,
okay.
paying for him. But essentially, you know, while they're... Because I believe in your situation, you went to prison. While they're in prison, they're not paying on the court.
Okay, all right, thank you.
And so they get released, and that's when they can get a job, they can start making income and making payment on their courts.
I will say this. Just recently, we had a transfer case from Jackson County that came to our office. One of our POs by the name of Darren Calvert took some significant steps to get restitution paid on this particular case. And Darren Calvert specifically received a letter of commendation from the district attorney herself, Beth Heckert, because he helped facilitate a $28,000 restitution payment to one of the victims in the Southern Oregon community. And so those types of efforts we want to encourage, and this is one of the ways that we're doing that, is to put it up on radar that we can do better in terms of collection of restitution, and we're going to do that.
Is that a model? I mean, did they just absolutely focus on that one case to take it? You know, instead of trying to hit a whole bunch of cases, just say, I'm going to take one or two of these a month, and I'm going to follow them through.
Yeah, one of the, I'll just tell you part of the detail is that this particular individual received an inheritance, and so the inheritance...
Ability to repay it.
Yeah, and through motivational interviewing, tactics that Darren had deployed, this particular individual agreed to give that $28,000 up to the victims that he has, and that was facilitated by Darren, and he didn't necessarily have to do that, but he went above and beyond, and he was recognized by another jurisdiction for his efforts. So that's something that we're very proud of. We want to encourage to continue to look out for the victims that have been destroyed and impacted by our offender population. So that is stay tuned on our progress for restitution collection. Mental health first aid training is coming up for the department. Because we have an office or closure on Friday afternoons, we're able to deploy department-wide training those Friday afternoons, and so mental health first aid is coming up, and we're thankful to our partners at Options for facilitating that training. In our custody alternatives program, as you can see with the numbers for WART crew, we're a little lighter than we have been last quarter, but very comparable. Our home detention numbers, conversely, have gone up. And some of it could be explained by the cold weather. Significant division notes in home detention is that we had an internal candidate that got promoted from the case specialist position is now a PO. So we have a current contingent offer of employment for another candidate we're very excited about, who happens to be an internal candidate that is familiar with community corrections. And we got to go through background and pre-employment screening before we announce the name. New technologies for home detention are being developed, and we're going to a training to get schooled on what some of those systems might be. So we may be making some modifications in our home detention to incorporate the new technologies, which would include voice and facial recognition on smartphones. The other thing that the division supervisor, Annette Sorensen, is very proud of is that we're starting the low-income and veteran services for firewood again, because the cold weather is coming. So you can visit UCAN or Veteran Services Office to apply for those services. All of that is donated, by the way, from ODOT, Grants Pass, City Grants Pass, private donors. And so we have a good partnership there, so we want to thank ODOT and City of Grants Pass for allowing us to have the donated wood so we can get it out to the people that need it. It's getting cold out there, so they appreciate that. In our treatment services division, our population rose from 77 last quarter to 119. Part of that is because of the treatment accountability group and our focus on high-risk offenders and getting them those services. Our secure treatment went down from 44 to 26, and I think part of that is explained by longer-term sanctions, that folks are serving a little bit more time in the secure treatment, effectively getting more cognitive behavioral therapy while they're incarcerated, which is promising. We'll keep you updated on the secure treatment piece of it. Our ADIS was the exact same numbers from last quarter. Significant division notes. We filled an alcohol and drug counselor position and also a case specialist position. The case specialist position will be geared towards a mentoring program and that development in partnership with Welcome Home Oregon. And our alcohol and drug counselor will alleviate some of that burden of the 119 folks that we currently provide treatment for. Also, in addition to the case specialist position, we're wanting to streamline our billing process, and that will be another focus for that new position. So thank you, commissioners, for approving that addition to our department. Other significant department notes, our community corrections plan contract was ratified with the state, so thank you for that. I presented a couple of weeks ago before you, and thank you for agreeing to that contract. The budget was approved for over $11.3 million for the biennium. Also, justice reinvestment funds approved by the state for $2.2 million, as which I provided that information last week. And thank you again for agreeing to that contract with the state. We just wrapped up the statewide time study. It occurred from September 5th through November 5th. And it could justify, and that's not a typo, $1 billion allocated to community corrections statewide for the next 6 years after the current biennium. We are in the process of constructing internal offices. As I just reviewed, we had a couple of additions from the treatment services division as well as field services. And so we have some internal office spaces that are being developed, and we're not going to extend out into the parking lot yet, although that was a proposal by Ryan's office, and we're thankful that he hired an architect to look at those things. But at this time, we're going to put those plans on hold. The violent persons file is being developed in terms of policy locally. This is an initiative from NCIC and the Oregon State Police. That the whole goal is to really keep our officers safe out there in the community. When somebody is ran, they will come back as a violent person, so they will take extra steps to keep them safe. Maybe it's calling for backup or checking in on that that particular subject differently. So that's something that's in the works right now, and we're thankful that the feds as well as Oregon State Police are taking those initiatives, and we will follow suit with a local policy. The Ethos Partnership, developing for ethics training and long-lasting meaningful careers in law enforcement. I don't know if the general public is aware, but I know the county commissioners are. There's an ethics bulletin that DPSST publishes every month. And every month there are officers that are sworn that lose their certification because of ethics violations. We don't want to be on that bulletin ever. And so these are some of the initiatives that we're taking as a local department to ensure that we're ethically sound. And nobody wakes up that morning and says, you know what, I'm going to ruin my career today. And it's a slow boil, it's a slow process, but we want to make sure that we correct any of those ethical violations or before they even happen within our agency. So Ethos is a partnership we are developing. We had our first training in October. I got very good feedback from the folks that attended, and we're looking to increase the amount of ethics training that we receive. By the way, DPSST has made it mandatory as of 2020 to have 1 hour of ethics training per year to maintain certification. So we are going above and beyond that and have gotten ahead of the curve. So that's a good, promising thing. The Department of Corrections officially enacted the evidence-based sanctioning grid under OAR Chapter 291, Division 58. Of note, we've already implemented that as of January of 2017. We're seeing some positive results with the evidence-based sanctioning grid. And just by the way, we've also implemented the evidence-based incentives grid as well for the department, which complements the sanctions grid. So with that, that's our quarterly report for these last 3 months.
I do have a question.
Yes, sir.
Going back to earlier and at this meeting, we talked about vacation, burnout, and people taking time off that are needed. Mm-hmm. Sounds to me like where you're talking about in your Ethos partnership,
yes,
you said, you know, you don't want a slow boil and a guy getting up and saying, you know, I'm done. I'm gonna go out with a bang today. I think that time off and a little time to decompress is very important in that process, mm-hmm. that they don't get to that.
Yeah.
So do you track or monitor the vacation schedules for your employees and how much time? Because I don't, you know, sometimes employees say, you know, I'm just going to take this comp time and add it all up, mm-hmm. and then I get a new ski boat at the end of it.
Yeah.
And rather than saying what it's designed to do, the military gives you 30 days off every year for a reason. Because you need time to decompress, get back down and get grounded again with your family and take a vacation, get away from it, mm-hmm. and then you can come back and work that steam plant on that destroyer.
Yeah.
But I didn't know if there was a tracking system within your department, because I think your department and, say, for instance, the sheriff's department, that would be paramount mm-hmm. to know that these people aren't getting wound a little tighter click by click mm-hmm. until something breaks.
Yeah, you know, quite honestly, in our field, in law enforcement in general, we don't do a very good job of taking care of our people mentally.
Right.
And so,
and you've got a room full of caseworkers and psychological, you know, psychology people and so on and so forth, but you don't turn that inward.
Right. And that's a very difficult.
I mean, chaplain, you would do that. There used to be a chaplain at the sheriff's department. There isn't a chaplain anymore.
Yes,
no place for
the work doesn't stop. And so because they're caseworkers and they have hearts to help people,
okay.
it's hard to take time away when you know other people are depending on you and that work continues while you're gone. So they take responsibility for, they have to do that. So you really have to, it is challenging to take time off and it is hard to make people take time off.
Yeah, so to answer your question, technically speaking, we track everybody's accrual, vacation accrual. We do monitor in terms of approval of time off and vacations, but we are. I'm going to tell you just flat out. We do not proactively seek out our personnel to make sure that they're rested. In fact, quite conversely, we're putting the agency first in terms of making sure we have office coverage and serving the needs of the public and providing services, and we're stats driven in those ways. But we can definitely improve in the area of being proactive to make sure that our folks are rested up. And currently we don't have a mechanism for that, but I can definitely be a little bit more proactive if that's the direction the board wants me to take.
I think your program is probably one of those things where Commissioner Moore is right, the work doesn't stop. Mm-hmm. It's not like Public Works where you can hold off on replacing chip sealing, blah, blah, blah. Somebody else can do that job. When you've developed a relationship with your clients and as a parole and probation officer, and that's the only thing that I'm in your program that I'm speaking to, of having 30 clients plus clients, you know, with your number cresting over 1,000, what is your average caseload per parole probation officer?
It depends. We currently have 18 POs, and so 18, you know, they're 1,000 divided by 18.
Yeah.
That would be the average. But the way our program is designed is that we have what's called the reduced supervision. Everything is based off of their risk. Mm-hmm. So if we have a high-risk caseload, we want fewer numbers on those caseloads. If we have a lower-risk caseload, we want higher numbers.
Right.
And so
it's not easy to compare apples and apples.
Right.
60 to 40 or something like that.
On the general caseloads, we want to maintain around 40 to 45 high- and medium-risk clientele to supervise. That's pretty much that's like the sweet spot, ideally, because we're doing all kinds of things with caseload management and making sure that we're abiding by the evidence-based practices. And, you know, we want to keep those numbers down. However, we're seeing an uptick in demand for our services. And so, you know, all that ties into trying to get time off.
Yeah, well, I just think it's something you need to be aware of.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like you're attacking it here, but, you know, go a step further into the root of the problem. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, my wife's great about it. She goes, you haven't taken time off in a year. I'm having so much fun here. I think it's great. This is almost like vacation.
Yeah.
Only different.
Yeah.
I think it's just something that, you know, before you get to that slow burn, mm-hmm. you know, maybe have, I don't know, a place they can go. I don't know what that would be. I don't know how to describe that.
Yeah. Yeah, there is EAP that's offered in our field. As you're obviously aware, it's difficult to ask for help because we are the people that are supposed to be offering the help.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult thing, you know, within law enforcement community we're trained to see the warning signs within our clientele and. The one thing that we have that's a very good thing within community corrections is a family-oriented atmosphere. People are very, very much connected personally, and those things help because if you just show up to work 40 hours a week, put in your time, and then leave, you know, it's difficult to know, you know, people and the folks that we work with. But in our agency, it's not that way, and so those things help.
Okay.
I think it's a good thing to just be conscious of from a manager standpoint and putting together a structure that facilitates it. I'm not going to presuppose that I could understand how you should structure it, but for me, an opportunity with 18 different people, having somebody whose load is lighter and that can say, you know, that's just the jack of all trades. They go from person to person picking up the slack for that week that they're off, and they don't actually have a caseload assigned to them. They are assigned to the caseload that is available with somebody, and it just takes everybody being conscious that there really can't be too many of those all at the same time for somebody to be able to, I don't know.
It's like a roving
probation officer that, I don't know if your system has the capacity to accommodate that, but that would be almost necessary. And out of 18, you know, 52 weeks, that's exactly how, I mean, somebody's got to fill in that gap. It doesn't just stop when they're not there for a week.
Right.
And a week isn't very long. And in 52 of those, to just be
honest. Well, if you get 2 or 3 weeks vacation a year, mm-hmm. now you're going twice a year.
Yeah. Anyway, something to be conscious of. The other thing was that I wanted to chat about was, maybe not today because we've got a couple more things on the agenda, but the LIPSC program, mm-hmm. and I think you're going to be chair next year, or is that chair now?
I think we'll find that out today because we have a LIPSC meeting at 2 o'clock.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm currently the vice chair, and traditionally the vice chair goes into the chair the next year.
Yeah, I think that in my tenure, there has been not exactly a great connection with the Board of Commissioners and LIPSC, and it has changed depending on who's been the liaison, but I think to find the whole system being as effective as possible, it'd be great if we could kind of work on that connection in the next year and try to really get it up as a back and forth. I don't think the board asks for as much of a recommendation on different things as probably could happen. And LIPSC, I have never been asked, I don't believe, from LIPSC about what is the board's direction on certain things, maybe through the liaison, but not as a specific question. The board comes back, deliberates, and then gives LIPSC an answer. So more of a healthy exchange between those two, where we can be supportive of each other, would be really, really beneficial. I think as the funding streams from the formula change in the marijuana money, we didn't ask LIPSC this last time. I think the need was pretty great relative to the issues that we're dealing with, but you know, that enforcement element of having a lot of people that are just not doing what they need to be doing through the programs, either OHA or OLCC. Once, if we can get a year or two of compliance into that aspect, there may be the element to say, well, what does LIPSC see as that low-hanging fruit that we need to continue to address, and where can we appropriate? If there are additional funds through the formula that come in, that's the obvious ones, but I just like to see ways of communicating better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be happy to facilitate that process of more open communication with the board, and
that'd be great.
Yeah.
Anything, Commissioner Morgan?
No, it has been interesting as we're Director Gowron and I are on a subcommittee through LIPSC that's looking at developing some bylaws, and just looking at the history, what I learned is from 1977, when the state first initiated through state law that the counties would run a local public safety council, it's from the time of 1977 through 2004, the commissioners were actually the chair of LIPSC, and other members would rotate through the vice chair position. And the idea, and even in the language of since its change in 2004, our local resolution is now the group plus their chair and a vice chair, is that the group is legally convened by the commissioners. And the task that we have in order to get done and the kind of that measure, I think it is important that we facilitate a better relationship and a more engaged. It's our responsibility as the board. It's the state is not directing all those other agencies to convene a meeting. They're directing us to convene the meeting. And so I look forward to seeing kind of how this plays out. And, you know, I think the reason why it changed is commissioners weren't taking responsibility or their responsibility is thoroughly, or maybe thinking they're not the experts, so give it to somebody else. But that's just it. We're the ones financially responsible for the program. It is our program. So whether or not it's our expertise or not, we still need to be at the table talking about the direction where LIPSC's going and kind of guiding that conversation. So I look forward to seeing how that plays out.
I'll do my best, Commissioner.
I see LIPSC as a resource that the board can use to make the best possible decisions to facilitate the resources in a way that's most effective and to coordinate that. I think that's exactly what we're looking to try to achieve, and any way we can partner to make that that goal a reality is key. So thank you very much for your leadership in that, Mr. Guy Rand.
You're welcome.
Board Deb.
Thank you.
All right.
I'll stay around.
Yeah, that's right.
Item number 4 is finance report and business update. Mr. O'Hare is going to lead us through item number A, amendment to grant agreement with Oregon Department of Forestry for Title III funds. Title III funds expired, the program has not been renewed since the expiration of Secure Rural Schools appropriations in 2015 in October. However, we still have Title III funds that we're able to appropriate within the confines of the applications that were approved during that period. and we can make financial adjustments up and down within those programs. And I think Mr. O'Hare is bringing to us an adjustment in that. And
it's an extension of an existing contract with Oregon Department of Forestry to allocate Title III funding for the FireWise communities for this coming year of 2018. So it's existing contract, continuation of the work that they're currently doing, and we're just doing an extension for the coming year. And so I would ask the board to, Sarah Rubrick, our interim emergency manager at this point, or fill-in, is getting the Oregon, getting the signatures from ODF. On this contract now. We gave it to her last Tuesday, a couple days ago, and so I would ask the board to move this to the Wednesday business session for approval, and at that point in time we should have the approved contract from ODF also, or the extension.
So we should be able to wind this all up by the end of the year.
Right, yes, and have it in place for January 1 and moving forward.
Sounds good.
So that's the main piece, and then Hugo Hills, I just wanted to give you that update that I have communicated with DHS Mental Health. They are requesting a monthly update on the progress of our reusing or re-establishing a residential treatment facility in the Hugo Hills facility. So they're asking for a monthly report, and I told them I would do that and get them one in January will be the next one. So just an update on that. And then also on our North Valley Industrial Park, we're meeting next week with a consultant, or at least a potential consultant, to take over the or provide guidance on the wastewater treatment plant and the sewer district and that with NVIP and the airport. So
sewer and water project management through Infrastructure Finance Authority and other business organ related funding streams to get that done in 2018. Correct. Get it well underway. Shovels in the ground. So I think we need
Correct.
To take our studies and put them to good use before they expire and get old. And so putting somebody in charge of this who's done it before, who wakes up in the morning.
Well, it seems to have stalled. It's been stalled for a long time, and maybe this
person will just say, okay, here's your next step. Continuation,
this is how you need to get there.
Yep. Yeah.
So I'm in favor.
Great. Anything, Commissioner Morgan?
No, I'm glad we're moving forward with that, though.
Excellent.
As far as the Hugo Hills one, we're also in touch with that group as far as they're waiting on confirmation from the CEO, and that's kind of the next step for them. So we're keeping in communication so we can hopefully keep on track with that one with Arthur's reports.
That'd be great. The one I had was I met with, from a financial other business kind of a deal, is I met with the group we delegated to negotiate the lease agreement with the Southern Oregon Air Academy for the 210 Tacoma property. There's going to be a need to get that up to kind of par with an updated certificate of occupancy. And facilities read is that could cost somewhere between $30,000 and $40,000 to get initially up to speed. And they, as a fledgling organization, they're not coming in with a lot of capital money to get that up to speed, but it really is kind of a requirement of to occupy. And so given that it's our facility and it really should be maintained in good stead to where a certificate of occupancy, regardless of who's going to be utilizing it, probably would be required of us to get it to that marketable point. And so I just wanted to bring that update that everything else in the lease negotiations has gone really smoothly. I think we're looking at a duration of time and the opportunity to revisit stuff in a timely fashion. Makes a lot of sense, but that initial startup might be something we need to look at in-house, and we can certainly use it's at the discretion of the board to either borrow, borrow against the building maintenance reserve, or grant economic development dollars that could be utilized to bring that up into you know, into par, so somebody could move in, kind of a shovel ready. There's a whole host of different funding elements, but what I wanted to just bring to the board was I thought the intent of the board is to really lean into this effort, and we don't want to lose it for the sake that it's not shovel ready. So I want to ratify my intent to say we will figure out a way to make that those updates happen.
I always hate to use the word borrow, and you're going to borrow to bring it up to standard and to gain the certificate of occupancy. That's just regular old maintenance, because you will have, if we go through with our contract at $1 a year or whatever it is, you have no ability to repay that loan if you borrow it.
It's how we structure it. I would say that, you know, we have asked them, we're using the Y lease agreement that requires a capital infuse annually to update, maintain that asset.
Right.
And it's an annual report that comes into Arthur through Ryan and, you know, make sure that they're investing money in updating that. We could say that it's front-loaded, that when you get grant funds, we're going to do this work now, and you're going to pay us back when you get into those grant funds, because after we do this, there may not be a whole lot for them to do initially. As the program grows and they need to rebuild or remodel some area or close in that outdoor recreation area, then they have a need to keep infusing money, but there won't be a whole lot of, I hope, a whole lot of capital need after we invest $40,000.
Okay.
So maybe that first year is just a repayment, half, all of it, depending on how we can work it out. But I didn't want them to be held up. They're ready to go.
No,
they've got a grant.
I agree.
Of nearly $400,000 for operations.
Unsold
and staff.
Unsold on their operation.
So I think that there's money there. It's just not ready for capital. So.
I think it's our responsibility. We need to do our part to get it occupied.
Yep.
And it's our part, I can't speak, our fault that the occupancy was lost. So I think it's on us to get it going if we want to utilize that space.
Okay.
I agree.
I'd say that it wasn't, we inherited the idea that it wasn't being utilized as it was intended through the previous leasee. So I'm not sure that we're at fault a whole lot. I think you've been proactive in getting this through the airports. That's something we're going to have as a long-term tenant, and that's been really positive. So we'll work on some sort of a financial structure that works for the Southern Oregon Air Academy, but if I'm going to give them grant funds, it would be ideal if it, you know, benefited both, and this might be one of those elements where, you know, we just get it up to speed and move it forward. Sounds like a really exciting program that I don't think any of us any idea of where it's going to go in five years. So I just felt like we were really supportive in whatever we can do to help. So anything else, Arthur?
That's what I have.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Other business, so we can move right into board business. We have a regional solutions representative here, and we wanted to talk about regional solutions funding as one of those elements. Do you want to come up?
Sure.
That'd be great. Maybe sit over here where the recorder and Commissioner Morgan.
Of course.
Really glad to have you here, Alex.
Yeah, good to be here.
The issue comes up that we're not always as proactive about, and I know regional solutions, if I can say, as I've been the liaison to that for a while, I'm not currently, but I don't want to feel like we get the short end of the stick, because we really haven't applied for the resources that have been appropriated the way Jackson County has. But if just a little bit of backstory, there's been this, since the appropriations, there's been two biennium, and in the past it's been $2 million to the region each biennium, so that's $4 million. And I believe we actually, the only application we put in, we were granted for. It wasn't for the full amount. We applied for, I believe, $525. We were granted maybe $380 of that, and which satisfied the need for the engineering of the East Side Taxiway. Couldn't have been more successful, as our goal was achieved, that it put it on the FAA's radar to get that East Side Taxiway under construction, and we're doing it right now. I mean, it's underway. So what I didn't want to do is that it feels like we're always behind the eight ball and strategically looking at ways that there's certainly a need in Josephine County. I think we're due a certain amount of the future funding appropriation, I don't want to say that funds is something we're focused on because regional solutions provide so much more than that, but we are not taking advantage of a regional approach to the appropriations in a fair and equitable manner. We've been appropriated less than 10% of what has been allocated to the region, and we often feel like we're getting the short end, but we've never asked for something. So what I appreciate, I think, who's the liaison, Commissioner Morgan?
Morgan, yes.
To that, putting it on the agenda so that we can have an opportunity to talk about looking at potentially other regions is what I had as a thought, and saying that's what they're doing. Broadband is certainly low-hanging fruit for, we have 10 times the national average of online businesses in Josephine County. They're home-based. They don't have storefronts. So you don't really see them, but they're employing a greater number of people in our local economy. And what can we do to improve the internet infrastructure to facilitate that in a broader way is something I thought we could kind of focus on. Commissioner Morgan, did you have kind of thoughts along this that we can tease out?
You know, I'm very new to regional solutions. I've been liaison, I think, a month, maybe
yeah.
two, been to one meeting. As far as projects to me that I see as regionally that would be most beneficial for future economic, other than broadband, which I do support, would be the North Valley Industrial Park expansion of the sewer system up there, as well as getting water out to that area. For our airports and the economic expansion to that area. So to me, that would be an area of focus that would have lasting impact on economic drivers.
No, that's really a good point. I think those are the two big low-hanging infrastructure things.
Yeah.
I think
and that North Valley, you know, Commissioner Morgan's absolutely right. That North Valley thing, it's been on the end of everybody's tongue for year after year after year after year after year. We just don't have the resources to kick it over the edge, you know, and some help along that line, and because it's extremely important to the Rogue Valley, especially with all the new improvements to the airport stuff out there. That place is just ripe, and I've used Madras's airport when they finally got stuff in a huge economic impact for that whole area. And I think we're in queue. We should be in queue to do something very similar.
Can you lead us through maybe the process timeline?
Yeah.
I know that the legislature didn't fund at the full ask, but then there's conversations that were going on. Maybe those have expired, but about additional appropriations, maybe ways we can partner in asking for those
right.
additional resources.
Right.
So,
just to clarify the numbers a little bit, I believe the last biennium is about $800,000 that was in the region. So
was it? It wasn't two again.
No, it was. I'm the biennium before that. I'm not as familiar with, but yeah, it was about $10 million statewide. So about $1 million per region.
Okay,
and it got trimmed down a little bit. So at least the past biennium, Josephine County did pretty reasonably well, fairly close to you know what the. Population.
The first biennium, I think.
In fact, a little better than a population.
The first one of regional solutions was a $2 million appropriation per region.
Right.
And I'm not so sure we got it, maybe any of that
right.
one. And then it went to maybe $1 million. And
right. And so what we have this current biennium, and we don't have it yet, it'll be the timing is these dollars would be available in about a year and a half. The state does its biennial bond sale. In the spring of the second year of the biennium. So there are two different things happening. One is because we got the regional solutions infrastructure fund got significantly less money than we had requested and had been in previous biennia. This biennia, there's only $4 million appropriated as opposed to $10 million and even more than that the prior. We are expecting to and hoping to have a conversation with the legislature in the short session and present some just example projects. Not necessarily, it's not required to be on that list to be funded, and being on that list I don't think, you know, doesn't give
those projects any advantage to the application process. But we did do a solicitation or request for expressions of interest. City of Grants Pass did submit the Spalding Park, the Spalding Business Park here. Just to echo what you all were saying, I mean, when I look at the cost of infrastructure to serve Spalding versus North Valley Industrial Park, I mean, I think North Valley Industrial Park is a logical priority. But that's all really just an exercise about educating the legislature about the scale of need around the state. So in this coming spring, hope we will have a formal application process. There'll be a written application due late spring, early summer, and the advisory committee would make a recommendation late summer, early fall next year. And then our hope is to have that approved by the e-board rather than taking it to the full session.
Sure.
Of the long session. So that's sort of the process, and so I think your timing to be thinking about exactly what you want to position for that is perfect. Hopefully, there is an opportunity to increase the size of that pot. So, certainly when those discussions are going to be happening at the legislature, very happy to keep you all informed if there's an opportunity to talk to legislators about that,
sure.
The use of those funds. There are a couple other things that we're working on just in this context that I want to make sure that we're on your radar. One is that the Regional Solutions Cabinet, which is, I'm sort of related to, but it's a group that exists in Salem, and it's the agency directors of the key regional solutions agencies and a few others. The governor asked them to look at workforce housing sort of last summer, and we did some focus groups with both developers and employers, and also solicited some information from businesses and localities that were really struggling with that, all to put together a pilot project. And we've got a little bit of resources. It's about $1.5 million. We want to do 2 to 3 pilots around the state on projects where we can particularly use this to get employers themselves involved and engaged in the development of housing. And that formal announcement just came out on Monday. I sent it out to the advisory committee on Tuesday. That application's due end of January, I think. So that's another opportunity that you all should be aware of. And then the other piece
what would a project like that look like? I mean, I see the money, right. But I'm not
is
sure.
Is it just more money?
What's the business?
Sure. So what we're able to identify in these discussions with the developers and the employers was that really asking the question, clearly there's the demand out there for multifamily housing, right? Rents are going up, and employers are it's a barrier to hiring, particularly among the medical industry.
Yeah, and we have that issue, but I don't know what I'm going to do to build housing. I mean, we're an employer here. We've got 350 employees. I just don't know.
Right. So I think the two things that we identified as possibilities would be one, there are a lot of institutions, Asante, for example, that has surplus property. And would they be willing to use that for some kind of equity stake in a development? Or would they be willing to essentially take a master lease on some portion of a number of units? And both of those things really to be able to increase the amount of financing the developers can take. What the developers were telling us, really, the barrier to them jumping in right now is they can only really leverage one-to-one. The banks are only willing to lend 50% of a total project cost, and there just isn't the financial incentive for them to do that.
They don't have capacity to do and have the leapfrog element that they have to complete something, get it sold, get it leased, and then move to the next one.
Right.
And that's a cumbersome linear process as opposed to parallels. That's an interesting thing where you could do like a public-private partnership, and it doesn't have to be focused on a low-income element. It just has to be housing, and I think at any capacity within the portfolio in our area. That would be really interesting. I think we've got property. Dawson County has more property than any other county in the state, but that would be used for housing. We've got a number of parcels that could possibly be developed in that sense. So
I look at the fact that, you know, when we talked about it, we kicked around housing a little bit at governance the other day because Phil Henderson from Deschutes County, he's got a big problem. He and I agree on an awful lot of things on that along that line. Being he was a contractor. I've been in the construction business all my life, and the big thing that comes to bear is all the rules and regulations. There is no section in our deal that says a shelter house, just a starter home. But the time you get all the EPA steps in and the Department of Energy steps in and says, no, you've got to have that 21 SEER heat pump. When basically, actually, if they actually did the math and used physics, they would find out that if that spot heating in a house with a little baseboard heater or wall heater in each one of those rooms and shut it off when you leave the room is going to consume less energy. I know it's BTUs per watt is what they're going, but that's the only thing they're focusing on. Mm-hmm. And another thing, Bill Lovelace, he's done he's all over the state building family units. His last estimate was because of the cost of building that is $220,000 per apartment. So what do you have to charge for that $220,000 apartment? No yard, no garage, no driveway, no nothing. You think that you would be able to get that down probably to half of that. Nope, here comes all the energy regulations and so on and so forth. And before you know it, you're clear off in left field. I brought up to Phil, I says, I did a tour at League of Oregon Cities of their low-income housing that they put it called the Lodge and Bend. It rivals Sun River, properties in Sun River, stone fireplaces and libraries and reading rooms and things. And I had to draw the line, and I hit the absolute ceiling when they took a tour of this lodge, and we went down and saw the heated subterranean garage for low-income housing. And I said, Phil, and he goes, we're building another one. Don't get so bad yet. You're just getting started. They're building another one over there. That needs to be put in check. And nobody seems to want to do that. And I don't know who's holding it back, whether the contractors are going, no, we love doing this stuff. As long as the government's paying for it. And there was no oversight as to when somebody moved in there and they qualified to live in there. I said, you come back in a year to make sure that they're not a pharmacist at Rite Aid now? And he goes, no, we don't ever go back and check. Once you're in, you're in. And you're subsidized by the housing authority or something. There was just so many ridiculous parts of it. But, you know, when we talk about housing, how can we... And I'm not saying build cheap housing and tract homes or something like that. I'm talking about that there used to be programs, 235 program when I was a young man and you weren't born yet, that really got people into houses because there was a housing shortage. And how can we get people, for instance, Josephine County, we have a relatively low mean income. They can't afford a $350,000 home. And that's what a house now, a brand new house, by the time you tag on everything, required by building departments, the Department of Energy, guess what? Now it's a $340,000 home, and people can't qualify for the loan, so now they're out there renting, and now they're running out of rentals, and because of the fact that multifamily housing is so expensive because of the same rules and regulation, and no deviation from it. They're asking the contractor to build something for nothing when they're the first 40% of the cost of it is regulation.
Well, the challenge is that the perspective of the legislature isn't necessarily addressing the problem. They're throwing some resources at it, but at the same time, they're adding to the burden on an annual basis, not looking at the efficiencies of what can be done to get people who you say are cold, who want to be warm, and who are wet, who want to be dry.
They want to be dry.
It just,
If you gave them a shipping container, they'd love it. They'd think they died and gone to heaven. But nope, we've got to make sure that nope, you're going to go from living outside my window out here to a $350,000 house, and it's your fault for not getting there. Why can't you get there? I don't understand why you can't get to this point. And that's a complete disconnect from reality.
Poor Alex. Got to figure out a way to...
Excuse me. I didn't mean to get off track.
No. I think it's certainly relevant. I mean, and the... I'm curious about the project you're talking about in Bend. I'm just curious now.
Oh, boy.
So I'll be interested.
I was furious. You can be curious because I was furious.
There's an ADU element that's on the books that we're exploring for the county and trying to take advantage of. I think the density of housing per lot, either in the urban growth boundary, city limits, or out in the county, I think that could change a lot, providing for people to do ADUs on existing property that has carrying capacity. But I really feel like you hit the nail on the head, having capital capacity to build these, get financed for them in the first place. And if we could, we need 155 units every year in Josephine County, and we did 106 last year. So that's a cumulative shortcoming that, you know, it doesn't take too many years, and you're already a year or two behind. How do you catch up? You have to get to 200 units a year just to address the backlog, and I'm not even sure that that's going to get us.
I look at the immediate problem, but we have Asante that hires people, mm-hmm. and they have no place to house them.
Right.
That's the immediate ramification of not having adequate housing or places to put them.
Right.
And because you basically regulated people out of it, can't build there, so on and so forth. That's the immediate part. That takes a long time to catch that back, because once you've lost that doctor to somebody someplace else, he probably isn't going to come back. And then the word spreads that, yeah, you can go to work in Southern Oregon, but you can't find a place to live. And I know it's the push to kind of move people to the larger urban areas. I got kind of curious the other day at AOC, they were talking about, well, gee, our rural areas are just declining. Gosh, on Friday, everybody's moving out of the rural areas. Well, what do you think you've been trying to push for all along? Move people to the city.
I think our Demick campus, Alex, is probably low-hanging fruit for this option. We've been working diligently at getting a NFA letter and remediating all of the challenges that we have there. Mm-hmm. It's zoned high-density residential, and I think the city would be willing to work with us if we were looking to retain a contractor in a public-private partnership to get... 100 units or something on that campus as a pilot project through the state. That might work really well for us. It's 6.22 acres. It's proximity to downtown and on transit service.
Right.
I don't want to put too much emphasis on the low-income element, because I think we have a workforce housing element shortage, and that frees up people to move into higher density, as a place to transition, get their feet under them for a couple of years, and then go buy that $300,000 or $200,000 house. It's something we're definitely interested in at the county level. So maybe we look at that as a working with our community development director. Let's circle back on this in the first part of January so that we're ahead of the curve, meeting that deadline for an application, if that's what we want to do.
Yeah. I'll make sure that Julie... is aware of and saw that announcement.
Okay. I'd like to get the height restriction. Get an allowance from the city to remove the height restriction, so that we're not just doing two story or three story. That we're able to do, something that can work for. Mm-hmm.
What was the old hospital? It was
four stories.
Four stories.
It's 50,
is there anything grandfather comes into
feet.
That or?
The city can. Make an allowance. Yeah. It's.
I know solar setback and all that other stuff is fairly new. 30 years ago.
Yeah.
That's something might have to be tweaked a little bit.
It's definitely a feasible property as well. Mm-hmm. So there's the building and safety community development place. You could take that building out on a weekend. There's not much there, and it's fully depreciated. And then that opens up that 4 acres on that side to get a start. Mm-hmm. And then you could go into it's not 4 acres, probably closer to 3, but you go to the other side of the road. So mm-hmm.
Right, right, there's some additional.
I like the faithful yeah. portion of that in the city. The state might be, yeah, that might work.
Absolutely, absolutely, okay. Yeah. And not to take us backwards, but I think a perfect example of the issue that you're talking about is the legislature, right, asks for some tiny house rules, and there's just a struggle to get that out of building codes division with any.
I don't know whether tiny houses are the answer too.
Because it's just an example.
Yeah, it's an example that I. If somebody had a regular house looking next to them, like a 235 house, they would, it's just a down, not downscale, but, for instance, my in-laws lived in a 235 house from back 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's got lap cedar siding on the mm-hmm. outside of it, and it's just by no means a thrown-together right. T111 house. Mm-hmm. However, it was very affordable for them to get in. Right. And the program allowed them to paint the inside and outside as a sweat equity down payment. We don't have any of those anymore. It's got to be all the way done, completed, done, finished, turn the key, ring the doorbell, you name it. And then that's where you get into that, there's no alternative for people to say, I want to help get this house up and I want to move in. Right. With it's kind of like Habitat for Humanities, except you're going to have a payment when you're done. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a compromise. Habitat for Humanity, you just hand them the keys and away they go, they've qualified and away they go. But there's a big group of people that say, no, I can afford a certain amount a month, but I can't afford that $12,000 heat pump and these style of windows and that style of this and so on and so forth. I just need the $12,000 heat pump can pay for all the appliances in the home, mm-hmm. all of them, right. and the roof.
The
only other thing in terms of resources, regional solutions resources that I wanted to mention to you is I did convene a Chetco Bar Fire Recovery Council, and they made some recommendations. And Commissioner Morgan was a member of that council. Our meetings were over on the coast, so I had some yeah. more one-on-one conversations with her. One of the pieces that is kind of merged out of that was there was a lot of interest in economic development planning, particularly in South Curry County. They've had all the salmon closures, and then they've got the fire on top of it, and they're sort of saying, is this tourism-based economy? I mean, is that realistic, or how do we adjust where we're going forward given reality? Oregon Shakespeare Festival also expressed some interest in demonstrating what their impact is on the Rogue Valley economy. But we looked at those two things and thought it might be an opportunity to get there's a legislative structure and economic opportunity fund that's never been funded that would give regional solutions the ability to do discretionary small grants, $20,000 here, $40,000 here, for feasibility type work and planning type work. And so we're going to present that to the legislature in the short session as well.
I have to use this opportunity to just say that the Board of Commissioners will not be supportive nor grants pass of Eco Northwest being contracted for any one of those economic studies. We had a really not so positive experience with retaining them for our economic development project. It was well in excess of a $100,000 grant, and the product that we got was so woefully short of our expectations, everyone's expectations, that it was embarrassing, relatively speaking, to what Cave Junction did for a small fraction of the cost, $20,000 for their 2020 look, that did a thorough job and was head and shoulders above what we spent 4 or 5 times as much. And they're just, I've heard that resoundingly. Klamath Falls retained them to do a weed management study. And I can't remember exactly what they spent. It wasn't chump change, and the product was embarrassing. And so I don't want to say anything negative, but I will just be cautious, and you should circulate that with your colleagues that
sure.
there are good contractors out yeah. there, and they should be retained to get a good product. When public dollars are spent on this, we need to be, aware of who's good and who's not.
Sure.
And yeah, so
absolutely.
We'd be definitely receptive to that, I think, for our area. We're at the tip of the spear of Jackson and Josephine County. We account for 30% of the state's buyers in any given average year, over a 10-year average. Mm-hmm. And we have the first national regional community wildfire protection plan. The challenge that we've experienced in the last 20, 30 years is the idea that we're supposed to transition from the foundation of a natural resource-based economy to a tourism-based economy, and that's proving to be correlated. They're tied, and you can't do one or the other without doing a little bit of both. And you can't have a tourism economy that's foundation is so shaky when we have smoke every summer as a reoccurring thing, and that reputation is gradually growing nationally, that can't plan on a trip down the Rogue or go to the Shakespeare Festival because it could be smoked out. That's just not okay.
Yeah, I was going to say Hell's Gate excursion, they had a huge economic impact. And when we talk about the economic impact of the fires and so on and so forth, I also heard the other day at a meeting that they said, well, you know, it wasn't that bad for, you know, if you ran the numbers in Brookings and Gold Beach, if you ran the numbers, economically, that fire probably brought more into their coffers than not. Because of the people they had to, all the motels were full, they were buying out shelves of food to feed this army of firefighters. And if you really look at it at that one-time snapshot, it probably, you could say, well, you know, it didn't hurt you at all economically, because look what happened.
But I'll just tell you that in addition to your argument that uh-huh. you're going to get to, that I'm sure, those numbers that we currently have are based on survey, and it's okay. And in a small economy, you get a small number of data points. Yeah. And the number of businesses that I talk to, I think the employment department's initial analysis is way low as far as the impact on Brookings. They did estimate there are about a couple hundred jobs in Grants Pass lost, which I think is probably more in line with the reality. I don't know why that didn't show up in their data, but they would admit that data is not particularly good until we actually get payroll data, you know, which is a quarter or two late.
Yeah.
But, sorry.
I just my final comment would be, well, if we made money because that Tetco Bar fire was there, if Brookings and South Coast made money on that fire, they were better off. See, at the end of the whole thing, they were actually, you know, no harm, no foul. That's a hell of a way to make money. I don't want to burn Oregon down every year just to bring the firefighters here to spend money. I don't want to do that.
Amen.
Thank you, Alex.
All right, thank you both.
Yeah, thank you,
Alex. Merry Christmas.
Good seeing you again.
Too. Nice to talk to you, Commissioner Morgan.
Merry Christmas.
Item number 60.
Hey, I do want to just make a special point to say thank you, Alex, because I know you moved around your calendar to get there today.
It's because of
you that I'm on the phone today and participating, because otherwise, well, I'm actually driving to the doctor's office now, but I really appreciate the effort that you took to be there today and moving things around to make us a priority, so thank you.
Not at all. My pleasure.
Yeah.
If it was up to her, she'd have been here.
All right.
But we said no.
Item 6B is Commissioner Morgan endorsement letter for the Bureau of Land Management Resource Advisory Council. You might remember I updated the board 2 weeks ago that I had applied for this. The logistics of that application process take about 6 months. It goes through the Secretary of Interior as a BLM issue. It's a two-year appointment, so if it takes 6 months to a year to get that appointment process done, I'm not here long enough to serve in any capacity. I think it's totally appropriate that Commissioner Morgan apply, and that I don't have any reservation in having a full endorsement of this board moving that forward. If you're inclined to accept that, Commissioner Morgan will endorse you for this position.
Absolutely, and I just want to say that I hope that as much I can learn from you or continue to learn from you and all the knowledge you've done on this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you would not be here.
Thing I can do to help.
Otherwise, you would be the right person for the job.
I applied last time and wasn't selected, and so I have no delusion that it will be any different this time. Commissioner Kelly Minty Morris, a well-qualified commissioner, however, she was just a freshman. She didn't have any natural resource experience on her resume prior to that. I don't know what else you could do to add to my resume. It's as comprehensive on every possible natural resource thing, so that's apparently not relevant. to being selected for this. So all that to say, anything I can do to help in that effort will be well represented if you're selected for that. I'm sure.
I think a full board
recommendation
is powerful.
It should be. I hope so. Yeah. I think I had last time too. So we'll see. Good luck, Commissioner Morgan. We'll get that done and in the mail ASAP. Item number 6C is Resolution 2017-055 in the matter of reappointment to the Doosan County Housing and Community Development. We've got a person for reappointment in that, Christine Mitchell?
Mitchell?
Yeah.
Mitchell, is that large? It's a reappointment to 4-year term.
We'll move that forward without objection.
No objection here.
Great. Matters from Commissioner?
No objection.
Great. Thanks, Morgan. You want to go first if you want to get to the doctor? Have anything otherwise?
I'm driving as we speak, so I still have me on Bluetooth. The lipstick one is one that I will be bringing back to the board for recommendation. Do you want the chair to be the commissioner and as the convener of those meetings, or do we want to continue with the process that started in 2004 with rotating annually with council members as the chair? That's something I think our board should weigh in on and decide what level of interaction we have on that council. That was one of the items I was going to bring up, but I think it's something that is more than just a liaison decision. It should be our full board's decision.
Absolutely, and I'd appreciate it if we had a chance to talk about that after we give it a little bit of thought. I'd like to review the bylaws. I haven't done that in years, but my quick read on this is I have confidence in Mr. Guy Rand's ability to steer this effort. I could see that the vice chair being the commissioner and that be a standard appointment, that the liaison to the LIPSIC is the vice chair, puts that leadership capacity at the table but doesn't necessarily steer. I like the idea that these groups are given a charge by the board and then the freedom to kind of explore it how they need to get us back a recommendation. It's a two-part issue that we need to lean into this and utilize this resource better, and then we see that partnership grow on the LIPSIC side of things too. So I'm not wed to any one decision, but I think we should talk about it, and I appreciate you bringing it to our attention.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm done.
The timing is that the group is actually developing bylaws to recommend to the BCC. There's never been bylaws. It's only operated under a resolution by the BCC.
Okay.
We did establish a council back in 1977, and in 1995 was reaffirmed in a resolution. And up till all the way through that time, the commissioner was not only the liaison, but the chair of the committee. The group picked the vice chair. And then in 2004, that changed when they started electing a chair and a vice chair. And what has happened in the culture of it is there's kind of a feel that the commissioners are secondary to being at the meeting, that it's not necessarily about them. It's about the council being law enforcement and criminal justice related, and we're just there. And what I found in the research of the history of it all is, no, we are the conveners of the meeting. We need to be taking a more active role, and we're not secondary. I'm not saying we need to run the meeting, but it is essentially the meetings are our responsibility. And especially with the Association of Oregon Counties partnering with a grant with the CJC to provide a LIPSIC coordinator, one of the models I saw in Douglas County, which is significant because we share the coordinator with Douglas County. Their commissioner is the chair of the committee, and that assigned LIPSIC coordinator works directly with the commissioner to make sure that LIPSIC is working on the things that the board is driving. And it's just a different model than I have seen, and some of the frustrations I have is that it's a council that operates independently of the board, and they don't feel obligated to include the board. So at some point, we need to kind of look at that because it is our committee. And that's kind of where it was coming from. So.
Okay, sounds good. I think we'll continue this discussion into the future. So we'll take a look at that. Is it a resolution or order? And then take a look at their proposed bylaws, and we'll move forward. So
sounds good.
Anything else, Commissioner Morgan?
No, the one question I had, you mentioned that next week will be our last week in business session of the year. We just want to make sure we clarify those dates because I'm intentionally trying to address travel time to be back in time for the one that's the week between Christmas and New Year's. So if we're not having a meeting that week, that would impact my travel. So I just want to make sure I know because I was going to make sure I was back to be there for that.
I'd like to see us try to work on getting the last weekly business session of the year to be the 20th, and we typically have taken off that week of Christmas. I know that whatever agenda items we would have, staffing in that time is kind of challenging sometimes as well, the 27th. So as much as I think some of us will be free if we don't have to, I think that would be beneficial. It also kind of comes back to people taking vacation time and being recharged and ready to go for the next year. One of the things that I think we've talked about with Mr. Guy Rand and other managers is you take lead by example. Taking vacation is an appropriate and necessary thing to do. So just a thought. I think we've got some time to think about that. If something does come up, we can try to address it. But without objection of the board, I think that makes a lot of sense to me.
20th? Being the last meeting?
I'm not objecting.
Okay. Excellent.
I'm okay with that.
Did you have anything, Commissioner?
The only thing, there's a lot of dirt going in the courtyard out here.
Yeah.
Every once in a while I see a truck backing in, and I'm glad to see that moving forward. It's about 4 months too late, but facilities has had a real busy summer.
They really have.
A lot of things going on, so I'm okay with that.
That they're on schedule for opening up the juvenile detention facility.
Oh, yeah,
That's a big deal.
Well,
and a top priority.
Director Gallurand's got a bunch of stuff going on over there.
Yeah. And finding contractors. He's still working on the courts project.
Very tough. We're okay. We're patient on it.
There's a lot of projects that facilities is facilitating, which is their job. So I would like to schedule the State of the County address for January. And we've talked about this, something I think we need to put on the calendar so that our managers that are going to be invited to present for a very short amount of time will be ready to do that. January, February, do we have a preference? February might be a good time.
February might be a good time. Like I said, the only thing, if we just make sure we put it on a schedule, because I'm going to be probably pretty busy on the road.
We'll figure out
January, February, and if that's the case, I can just schedule a day out and we'll go from there. I think it's important that the county have their State of the County address.
Yeah.
Very important.
I'm thinking at the fairgrounds, have it recorded and televised.
Yep.
In the big building there, either the flower building or the otherwise, but we should get into a routine of doing this annually.
Yes, I agree.
So the other thing is that we've been working on Public Works, having done the review. My goal is that the liaison, Commissioner DeYoung, I need a report recommendation proposal, and I'm going to say that my goal would be the second week of January.
Okay.
We've had a significant amount of time of this being out there. The charge that I have is our facility, that asset, is about a $750 to $1 billion asset. And it cannot be my legacy, or I would imagine either of yours, that we let that fall apart under our watch. We're doing 25% of our annual maintenance requirement, and my goal is that we get to 100. And I want to see how we get there. What does it look like for us to get to 100% maintenance goal? Maintenance, and if that means we are no longer maintaining 100 miles of county road, well, then so be it. If that means we don't do this anymore, we don't do that anymore, so be it. But our goal has got to get to 100% maintenance. So if you wouldn't mind conveying, if that's the will of the liaison, any objection to that, Commissioner?
I support that as well.
Okay, great.
No,
okay.
I support that.
Well, that's what I had. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, we're adjourned at 11:23. Get better, Commissioner Morgan. Thanks for being on the phone today.
Should send Wendy, send her a picture of your layout here.
Right.
And I delivered the book.
Did you?
To Mr. Hare.
It reminded me.
Because I started another one because you were yelling at me, so I started another one.
Okay.
Yeah, that book reminds me of
Simon and his dad. Oh, really?
Yes.
Well,
that's why I thought I'd better get it.
Your party looked like it must have been pretty good.
It was. Yeah, it was a great time. We had a fantastic time.
Can I have a grape, Wendy?
Yeah.
Hi, grape. Grape?
Yes, sir.
A grape?
No, thank you.
Make sure there's no bugs on it.
No bugs? No critters?
No critters. Good seeing you. Let's go take a look.
Yes, sir.